Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beats. I personally take Super Beats when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beats gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at intelligentbeats.com. That's intelligentbeats.com. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is part two of our weekly Q&A with Layla, where we answer your questions. Today we're with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. Say hi, Layla.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Hi, everybody.
Okay, and so last hour we previewed a question which did not admit to a short answer, which is, please read the question again.
Yeah, Dr. Hoffman, how do I choose a legitimate integrative medicine doctor?
Okay.
How do we do that? Yeah.
So, all right. This is a difficult question to answer because the standardization in the field of complementary and alternative medicine is frankly lacking. I mean, I gotta say that there are various types of certifications you can get. Now, I think there's a new board certification in complementary medicine.
Are you talking about integrative and functional medicine?
There's integrative and functional. And different organizations are competing for the ability to credentialize their applicants for to convey legitimacy on them. Now, I have to say that is a positive thing if the person has credentials, but it's very hard for a layperson to evaluate the credentials. The credentials may be from a mail order place, you know, where you just take a course by mail, and it may be an excellent course, or it may be a course where, you know, any dummy can pass, or you can enroll your Cocker Spaniel and get a certificate as an integrative practitioner. Mm-hmm. This was something that was mischievously done by a so-called quackbuster who wanted to out the integrative medicine movement. He signed up his dog for a his dog got a certification. So that isn't good. On the other hand, there's some excellent credentials. You know, I know Dr. Weil is offering credentials through his program at University of Arizona. The program is quite rigorous, and some of my colleagues have undertaken it. I think there's something to be said for practitioners who are experienced and have a good reputation, and word of mouth about their effectiveness is equally important. You know, if you know someone who has had an excellent result with a complementary physician in your locality, I think that speaks highly for that practitioner. You know, there's a certain amount of hype and self-promotion. Some people may promote what they do, but the best way to find out is not to read their self-descriptions or to go on their websites and, you know, hear what they have to say about themselves, but to talk to someone who's been there. Maybe, you know, go to a local health food store and say, hey, you know, do you know people who come to the health food store who've been to see X person? Now, also, when it comes to credentials, you know, you may want to see an MD if you have a complicated medical problem that, you know, where it's a question of taking you off a medication or, you know, evaluating whether you should undergo some complicated form of therapy, or are there interactions with your medications? I think being an MD helps you do that. However, there's some very good naturopaths, NDs. That's an emerging field. I've seen tremendous progress in that field over the past 20 years. There are chiropractors who are very well-versed in nutrition. They don't so much do the structural work or the cracking work anymore, but they do functional nutrition. And they're very well-schooled and very smart.
DOs.
There's DOs. Of course, I usually say MD, DO in the same breath because they're virtually the same training programs. And there are also folks like you, you know, registered dietitians, especially the ones who obtained an advanced master's degree, who either practice in the setting of an office with a doctor like you do, or some practice autonomously. You know, they have
The thing is, but we still have to make a differentiation.
Yeah.
Any dietitian can get their master's degree and be a mainstream dietitian and not an integrative one.
Exactly.
I was pretty much integrative from the get-go.
Yeah.
You know, so most 80% of my field experience is in integrative medicine or complementary and alternative medicine or whatever we were calling it then.
Well, let's talk about your field a little bit, because some people will say, I want to get expert nutritional advice, so I'm going to go to a registered dietitian. Are they going to get the kind of affirmative advice that's in the style of what we offer? Or are they going to get sort of the mainstream medicine party line, which is very conservative nutrition?
And that's where people need to be discerning, because I've had people come to see me after seeing another RD out there in mainstream because the diet they were put on completely failed.
Yeah.
So, and it had to do with following USDA and MyPlate and just following government standard issue. This is, and it's wrong.
And I'll give you, I'll give you another example. I have a relative, unfortunately, is a young fella, and he's got cancer. He's a newlywed. He's in his 30s. He's got a young child. It's a very challenging situation, and he's undergoing conventional medical care, which I agree with. I think that's the right way to go, but he really would benefit from nutritional support. Now, I, as a relative, I just feel like I can't be pushy, because the family is scared, and they want to follow the directions from this very prestigious oncology medical center that they go to. And I'm following with great frustration. They send me copies of correspondence to their nutritionist, who should be advising them on nutrition. And basically what they're saying is, don't take anything. Don't take any supplements whatsoever. And I happen to know that there are specific supplements that would benefit him greatly. And I think they only agreed to one of them. They said, well, one of them, you could. But they said, well,
let me guess. Was it curcumin?
No, they don't even want him to take that.
Oh, no.
But they said it was okay to take L-glutamine, because L-glutamine is going to help him with the mouth sores that are occurring and the diarrhea. It helps to protect the oral cavity and the gastrointestinal tract from the damage of this relatively high-dose chemo. It's pretty arduous for him. He's pretty sick with this chemo.
So does this make you want to pull your hair out or what?
You know what? It's just frustrating.
It
drives me crazy. But hey, you know, it's like this has been the situation for 30 years, my entire professional career, and what can I do? But I'm just pointing out that it's very hard, I think, for the consumer to find the right person. And I got to say this, and this is unfortunate, is that my field and the field of nutrition and the field of complementary medicine, unfortunately, is rife with, to some degree, fraud and opportunism in terms of charging people a lot for speculative therapies that don't necessarily work. And the rules are sometimes suspended, at least in conventional medicine. You know, they do dumb things, but the rules are the rules, and there's sort of a general consensus about what works. Now, what they believe works quite often is wrong, but at least there's a general consensus about what works. And you can see, you know, five different holistic practitioners for one set of problems, and they may come up with five different solutions. Hopefully this is more changing, because more standard procedures and education are getting people to sign on to a consensus about what works. So I think, you know, for example, there's general consensus that vitamin D is helpful, that fish oil is helpful, that now more and more people are signing on to low-carb diets and so on and so on. You know, but, you know, you can get any variation on that. You can have someone saying the answer to your heart disease is an ultra-low-carb diet, and the other person will say, no, your answer to your heart disease is an ultra-low-fat diet. And, you know, it's a bit of a free fire zone in terms of the facts.
That's true. But I think it's what you said earlier, word of mouth.
Okay. I'll also mention my own professional organization, which is called ACAM, the American College for Advancement in Medicine, ACAM.org. You can go there. That's a website. And there's a physician finder. So you can put in that you want to find everybody within 25 miles or 50 miles or 100 miles. I mean, if you're in the middle of Utah or something, you might have to drive, you know, 200 or 300 miles to find somebody who's going to be qualified to take you. But here in New York, you know, the same search you could find in your zip code, you know, 15 people.
Yeah. The other website to find if this person is looking for a nutritionist is Dietitians in Integrative and Functional Medicine.
Good.
DIFM.org. That could be a good starting point if you're looking for nutritional counseling, medical nutrition therapy, that type of thing.
So you see, this was a question we tried to answer the last of part of part one last time, and you know, it really takes a long time to discuss and answer
that. Because people are having trouble. How do they know? Well, I went to a nutritionist. This is what they told me to do. I thought they'd tell me something different from, you know, my primary care doctor.
Right.
Hopefully, they will tell you something different from your primary care doctor. So, yeah, it could be tough.
Yeah, and there are different people who are good with certain things.
Mm-hmm.
There may be someone who's really good. You know, I like to style myself as being very good with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, and a lot of patients are coming to me for that. However, that's not the only thing I do. I do a lot of other things. There's some complementary physicians who are superb at dealing with autistic children, and that's but that takes a lot of dedication, and you know they have to concentrate on that because. You know, that's a, you know, time and labor intensive discipline is how to cope with the problems of those types of children. And, you know, so it varies. It varies. And then, you know, the different modalities. I mean, for example, I'm trained in acupuncture, but I don't do acupuncture. If you want to get acupuncture, there's some fantastic acupuncturists who spend all day long working on 10, 12 patients per day, and they're super proficient at it. And that's the person you want to see if you want to do acupuncture, or perhaps you're interested in homeopathy, which is something that I don't do. There are people who are homeopathic practitioners, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, this is a terrific topic. This, a lot of people have this question. Or a lot of people have come through a lot of practitioners before finding your practitioner. Yeah,
it's not unusual that I see people who have been to many conventional doctors, sometimes many complementary physicians before they get to us.
Yeah.
So, and it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, they've tried everything.
That's true.
Okay, so what's our next question?
Our next question comes from Dennis. Let's see. At what dose does Ostanol build bone, and how fast? Does it even work for advanced osteoporosis, for instance, -3.1 in the spine and -2.9 in the hip?
By the way, what he just stated, I don't even consider that such advanced osteoporosis. That's a well within the range of what we help our patients with, even without Ostanol. Ostanol is bone morphogenic protein. I will say right up front, it's an expensive supplement, but I think it's a very effective supplement. We just had some good results with Ostanol with a patient who had a fracture. I told her right away, she called me up, she said, I broke both my ankles. I called her and I said, you know, have our office send you some Ostanol because it's a bone morphogenic protein, which means it's a bone building protein. Started taking it. I think she had a marvelous recovery. You should see all the screws that are in her ankle, but she's walking fine and she doesn't have a lot of swelling or pain. So,
showed us a picture. Remember that picture?
Yes. Yeah. So, and it's a relatively expensive supplement. I would use it for more, you know, if you want, you can use it for mild to moderate osteoporosis. I consider that moderately severe osteoporosis, not extreme. We have patients who are -4.2, -4.5. That's much worse. And there we would want to throw everything at it. Ostanol, I consider sort of a premium supplement. I think strontium and Ostera and vitamin K, high doses of vitamin D can be effective.
He actually has another question. He says, I have low DHEA. Is it okay to take a 10 milligram dose?
And the answer is probably yes, but that's not enough for most men. Mostly I start men on 25 and or 50, and I personally take 25 or 50 every day. And it is helpful for osteoporosis for both men and women. Women take less, generally 5 or 10, maybe 20. And yes, it is helpful. But should you do DHEA on your own? I'm a little cautious about that because I think you need some medical supervision. I would be concerned about the potential for worsening a prostate problem if a prostate problem were pre-existing. By the way, some very good news on the testosterone front. This is an aside. You know, DHEA is much weaker than testosterone in terms of its effect on the prostate, but nonetheless, there's an androgenic effect. But testosterone, of course, is the premier androgen, and a lot of doctors are very scared of prescribing testosterone to their men, even for andropause, fatigue, low libido, fat belly, lethargy, depression. But they don't want to give it because they're so afraid of the risk of prostate cancer. They did a 17-year study, I believe it was in Europe, in one of the countries in Europe, and they found, amazingly, no increase in the risk of prostate cancer. Now, you know, I would say if a man has got a high PSA or has got urinary problems or a digital rectal exam has revealed something suspicious, don't start DHEA or testosterone. But if you got a clean bill of health and your PSA is low, go ahead and get monitored. And I think that the danger of kindling a hidden prostate cancer is exceedingly low. I think I've seen only a couple of men who developed prostate cancer while on testosterone. Fortunately, I didn't prescribe it, but they came in after having been on testosterone. But I think that's just a coincidence. It's not that the testosterone caused the cancer.
It's not cause. We couldn't know cause and effect on that.
Right. The cancer may have been there to begin with. Mm-hmm. But certainly, you would have to stop testosterone if you had a cancer. When the cancer became clear that these men had cancer, they stopped their testosterone.
Right.
Okay. And are doing well.
Yeah. Terrific. Well, I hope that answers Dennis's question.
Yep.
All right. Our next question is from Sue. Dr. Hoffman and Layla, many women who have had breast cancer are taking Arimidex for a 5-year period. Arimidex is known to have a negative effect on bone density. Oncologists suggest taking calcium with vitamin D to protect against bone loss.
Doesn't do hardly anything.
Yeah, would you recommend strontium over calcium under these circumstances? Thank you, Sue.
Well, okay, so Arimidex is a estrogen. It's actually a blocker of the it blocks the estrogen pathway. I don't want to get too fancy about it. It's an aromatase inhibitor, and it can cause osteoporosis by the same mechanism that it deprives the cancer of estrogen, deprives the bones of estrogen, so you can get osteoporotic. And calcium and vitamin D really probably won't do a heck of a lot.
Yeah.
So you need some sort of more definitive therapy. And you can't use hormones. You can't use DHEA. So you need vitamin K, and strontium would be ideal under those circumstances.
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't have any negative effects on cancer, those things. Vitamin D is very important in preventing cancer.
Yeah, absolutely. What would you think about Ostera?
Absolutely. And the hops would have a great effect on the breast tissue as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that would be great. Vitamin K may even have some anti-cancer effects. So, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Sue, that's what you can do.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. Our next question is from Elsa. I'm a 59-year-old female, just returned Sunday from a trip to Puerto Rico. While I was there, I kept hearing about this chikungunya.
Yeah, chikungunya. Mm-hmm.
Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yep.
Well, it seems it was going around rampantly. Well, by Monday morning, I woke up feeling pretty sick with achy and stiff joints, and I struggled to even take a few steps.
Ooh,
what should I do?
Oh, okay. So, wow. We didn't receive that one 3 weeks ago. Did we just get that one? Yeah, here's the deal. There are two things that are going around the Caribbean. And lately, chikungunya, that's a real name. It means in some native dialect, it means, terrible aches and pains. That's what that word means. Like groaning pain, I think, is literal translation. And it is, I first became aware of this condition when I saw a woman a few years ago who came back from a trip to India, where it was confined to Asia until recently. It's a mosquito-borne illness, and she apparently got it. And not only she developed terrible aches and pains, and it actually triggered a full-blown case of rheumatoid arthritis, and she was devastated. So we treated her with our usual nutritional support. But And I thought, well, this is an aberration because it's just in Asia. Well, now we know that it's come to the Western Hemisphere, and it's come up. I was in the Yucatan Peninsula, and it had not yet gotten to Mexico, to the Mexican Riviera. But it is in Virgin Islands, U.S. Virgin Islands. It's in Puerto Rico. And also dengue is down there. So yeah. It's actually more likely that this person got dengue, and the symptoms are some virtually indistinguishable, because dengue causes more debilitation and weakness and less pain, but it can also cause pain that mimics chikungunya. And they're both mosquito-borne. And so what do? You go to the doctor, you get tested for it, but there ain't nothing that they have in the conventional arsenal for treating it. And I have not seen an acute case of it. But I'd welcome any patient who comes to me and says, I've just been diagnosed with this and I feel terrible. And I would tell them to come in daily for intravenous vitamin C if they could, because that's the fastest way to vanquish, some kind of acute viral infection.
Okay. Wow.
But, you know, taking oral vitamin C, I don't know if it's going to do much. You know, yes, you could take oral vitamin C. Perhaps you could take some selenium. You know, that may help. You know, a lot of people cannot access intravenous vitamin C. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Yeah, you can't take 25 grams of vitamin C or 50 or 75 by mouth. It would turn your insides out.
Yeah.
So only by intravenous could you take that much. So.
Right.
Also, we hope you're feeling better.
Yeah. Oh, what is a cautionary tale? I mean, everybody looks forward to going to a nice trip to where it's warm, but coming down with a terrible illness
especially
like that.
Especially now, especially lately.
Yeah.
Okay. Do we have time for another?
Yes, we do.
Great. This one comes from, again, we don't have a name here, but hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. My mother has been diagnosed with chronic sinusitis. She's 67 years old. She's been on rounds of antibiotics. Is there anything else she could do? They're suggesting that she go on yet another round of antibiotics for sinusitis.
Well, of course, that's
not. What is going on here?
That's not the answer. And, you know, the after a while.
She was also diagnosed with an ear infection.
Which is part of connecting through the eustachian tubes. I mean, this is, after a while, the bugs mutate and they become resistant to antibiotics. And they also, the very presence of these chronic infections and the use of antibiotics suppresses your own immune response. And then there's also the possibility that in the wake of all these antibiotics, a fungal infection has developed in the respiratory tract. So our job here is to not use more antibiotics, but to strengthen the immune system and also to break down the biofilms that contain the organisms. Those are present in the nasal passages and the sinuses. You can use clear nasal spray. We also have you know, some newer products that are designed to break biofilms. What's the new product that we got? That's,
I have tip of the tongue syndrome now.
Yeah, that is
but
the...
it's some type of an enzyme.
Right,
help
proteolytic enzymes that help to break biofilms.
Yeah.
You know, in the past, we used things like Wolb enzyme, which also has been used to boost the efficacy of antibiotics. We have a nice product called Sinatrol, S-I-N-A-T-R-O-L, that's formulated specifically to penetrate deeply into the sinuses with natural herbal action. And it contains N-acetylcysteine as well to thin the mucus. We could use high doses of olive leaf as a natural antibiotic, high doses of oregano as a natural antibiotic or antifungal. You know, even sometimes intravenous treatments to further boost the immune response. But then, of course, you know, some people just get chronic ear infections and nasal infections because they're eating foods that are mucus forming.
That's
and
true.
If you're allergic to a certain food, perhaps, I mean, we've cured many patients by taking them off gluten if they're gluten sensitive.
Dairy is a big one. Dairy
Huge.
Is a mucus maker.
Also,
without
high,
even being allergic to it. So,
also,
yeah.
Vitamin D, absolutely. You know, high doses of vitamin D are important. By the way, came across an interesting article today, which confirms something that I suspect. I've noticed that a lot of our sickest patients, and I sent you the article. I think you saw it this afternoon. A lot of our sickest patients have very low vitamin D.
Yeah.
So, and also when we give them vitamin D, it takes a ton of vitamin D to get the levels up. We're amazed at, like, oh my God, you're taking 2,000, 5,000, and your vitamin D still is relatively low. Well, there's this new study that suggests that inflammation may soak up your vitamin D. It may lower your vitamin D. So by virtue of, you need more vitamin D if you're fighting an inflammation of any kind. So our sick patients, they're very inflammatory, and hence their vitamin D levels are low. We see this in Crohn's disease a lot, colitis.
Yeah.
So
heart disease, yes. Metabolic syndrome, even. Diabetes.
Asthma, chronic infections, cancer even. So anyway, so that's the story. I'd love to treat chronic sinusitis. I think there's a lot we can do to break this vicious cycle of chronic infection. But conventional medicine, unfortunately, their tools are limited. And, if it works, fine. You're cured. But we see all too many patients who've been on 10, 20 doses of antibiotics, and they have also surgeries. They have these sinus surgeries. And it still doesn't help. Because those are the tools they have, or steroid sprays. And steroid sprays reduce swelling and inflammation, but they ultimately suppress your natural immunity, so you can't fend off the bacteria. So that's not good.
So then it becomes chronic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So there you have it.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Do we have time?
No, we're out of time.
Are we out of time?
So save it for next week. Right. But for our listening audience, if you have a question, you want to send it to radioprogram@AOL.com. We'll do our best to answer your question. And that's it for this week. I thank you for joining us. And thank you, Layla, for participating.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Q&A with Layla, part of our series of Intelligent Medicine podcasts. Thanks for joining us.